And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, big news in our world this week, and I'm not talking about how Tom Brady is going to be your coworker soon, or that, what did I just see? Lou Malnati's, your favorite pizza place, coming to Columbus, Ohio, next time you're at a Buckeye game.
I was hoping you were going to say it's coming to Southern California. It doesn't do me really, it helps Bill Landis, and it doesn't really help.
Yeah. I feel like you end up, both of us end up in Columbus at least once a year. The NCAA issued new guidelines Monday to clarify, to try to get started on some sort of crackdown of these booster collectives that we've been talking about for many months now that are quite clearly using NIL as an excuse to pay for play. We were all in Scottsdale last week. It was the talk of the town. They're tired of the NCAA sitting on the sideline. Gene Smith, the Ohio State AD, Rick George, the Colorado AD, a lot of these people, they're fed up. They want the NCAA enforcement to get off their butts and go bust some collectives. And so they put out this memo clarifying that collectives fit the definition of boosters, and these third-party memos? What do you call them?
I don't know. Release? I mean, memos feel like they're from like 1979.
Well, a lot of things about the NCAA feel like they're from 1979. They did both. They put out a press release and then they sent a document out to all their members.
Memo is short for memorandum, right? Mm-hmm. So there we have it. Okay.
I didn't know memo was considered an outdated term.
Oh, I think it is. I think it's in the era of like the phone booth.
Do people still say, when you're copying something, do people still call it Xeroxing?
Only people older than us.
Yeah. I think we're not far from people saying that about email. Anyway, your reaction?
Not surprised. You know, we talked about this last week in Scottsdale at the meetings. I mean, I did a story on Wednesday morning about, you mentioned Rick George. Rick George and the Pac-12 commissioner, George Kliavkov, were saying, you know, according to what we'd reported, that the NCAA is looking to make an example of somebody. The big issue, I think, as they were talking about it, was the NCAA definition of a booster is, once you're basically a booster, you're a booster for life. And the pay-for-play aspect of NIL, and we've talked about this a bunch in our podcast over the last month or so, NIL, in a lot of people's eyes, has devolved into pay-for-play. And whether it's a tiered system, schools may be having with NIL or not, but once it comes to these collectives, and you have taught, and you personally have been reporting and talking to a lot of agents who have been shopping recruits, I think that's where a lot of NCAA officials get very riled up, because it's seen as enticement. And that, you know, this is a function of the NCAA kind of punting for so long. And who was that guy who left after taking a bunch of millions of dollars and just walked away? The guy who ran the place. What was his name again? Mark
Hammert.
Yeah. Just complete lack of leadership. This is what it kind of got them. And then finally, it's basically if you leave schools to their own devices, There's going to be a lot of them, especially the desperate ones to become relevant again. They are going to get ultra aggressive, and the money people are going to come into this. And it, so it became this kind of feeding frenzy. And last week was really when it started to come to a head. And so here the NCAA put out from its board of directors on Monday, you know, and there's talk, well, will it be retroactive? They gave themselves the leeway to say it could be if it's egregious enough. But I also think what, you know, what I had heard was, hey, they're not really talking about punishing the players. They're talking about punishing the schools and the coaches. And, you know, you and I have talked about the elephant in the room with all these collectives and saying, hey, they're going to pay this player, this three-star, this guy, six figures. Well, obviously that has to be a there has to be a trail from these coaching staffs. We're also not just going to randomly pick who the collective thinks the school should take as opposed to who this coaching staff wants. There's just a lot of stuff to unpack here.
I think it's interesting that they're trying to define these, they're trying to say, you know, put out a blanket rule that these collectives should be treated as boosters because they are, yes, they are.
Funded. Why would they not be though? Like
maybe they should. I'm not saying I know one way or the other, but it is interesting because we think of a booster, we think of a person. Collectives are, you know, in most cases an LLC, a company, you know, that many people work for. Is the receptionist a booster? Is the, you know, the lawyer for the collective a booster? They're saying they are. So, they're trying to say anybody from that business that contacts a recruit is violating those rules. I think that's one of many things that could be challenged if one of these things ends up going to court, which it will. You know, I think in talking to, like you said, agents, lawyers, actual boosters over the weekend, they think that any attempt, like we think, we're college sports fans and we think it's obvious, right? A booster getting involved with a recruit is a violation. It has always been a violation. And I remember when David Ubbin's first article about Spire Sports, the Tennessee one, came out, being just, you know, bewildered and surprised that these guys were talking openly about how they meet with recruits, that they were going to, you know, put significant funds into the 2023 class. And I read back and read his article. They bragged that 7 of the 9 recruits they met with in last year's class signed with Tennessee. It just seemed like everything that I thought was a rule, these guys don't seem to think is a rule anymore, or they seem very confident that the NCAA is not going to enforce that rule. So now they're going to try to enforce that rule. And I do think they've got more ground to stand on if they're focused on the contact part of it, which was a rule before NIL, versus trying to mess with the money. But the counter argument that these people are making is, if you're saying to all these collectives, sorry, you're not allowed to participate. Like we're okay with athletes making NIL money, but we get to decide which kind of people get to give them that NIL money. That is an antitrust violation, because if you could successfully weed all the boosters out of this, I don't think they can, but if they could, then the dollar amounts would go down. There would be fewer bidders for their rights, and therefore a lawyer would gladly make that take that to court and say, you are manipulating the free market, you're suppressing these athletes' ability to earn compensation. And based on Justice Kavanaugh's scathing opinion last summer, many believe that it would end up exactly the same, that the Supreme Court would come down and say, that's illegal, you can't do that. But there are other lawyers who think it's not quite that clear cut. So I think that the NCAA must really like spending time in court, because that's where this is headed. Whichever school they, like you said, whatever, yeah, that's what I'm gathering, that they feel like, well, we got to at least try. We got to go down swinging. If we get sued again, and they say we can't do it, okay, but this is, they feel like this is a fundamental rule that their whole enterprise is built upon, that boosters can't bid for recruits, and so they're going to try to enforce it. But as you know, that could be very expensive for them. And I get the sense that, yeah, everybody loves to, like you said, rag on Mark Emmert, rag on the end. I think that the reason we're here is that after Alston last summer, Mark Emmert and the people, the lawyers that on that side of things, said, they were kind of realistic about it. We see where this is headed. Like, we can't try to enforce this stuff anymore. But the people on the ground, the ADs, the coaches, the commissioners were like, no. You have to enforce this. This is screwing with our sport. You hear, I often hear, you probably do too, people, coaches in particular, say, this is not what NIL was intended for. You know, no. We just wanted it to be autograph signings and endorsement deals. We didn't want it to turn into this, which I get it.
When you say this, you're talking about the recruiting aspect, not the players already in the program. That's the difference.
No, everybody's fine, I think, with the players who are already in the program making whatever deals they're making now. They probably, I don't know that that means, because what we are starting to see a little bit of, and I'm sure we'll see more of, is current player threatens to transfer if he doesn't get a better NIL deal. Boosters come back and give him a better NIL deal. That's kind of the same thing as inducing a recruit. You're inducing the kid to stay in school.
Or if he could stay as opposed to go to the NFL because he thinks the money is significant. I mean, I go back to this. It feels like forever ago, but it's not even a calendar year ago. I remember the first night of the Elite 11, which was in Los Angeles. It's probably about 11 months ago now. And I remember I had turned in a story where I had talked to coaches, head coaches, about NIL. And I just remember like having to walk some of our editors through because they were like, but this isn't how the rule is. This is not, because it was like everyone was kind of operating. And one particular coach was like, oh no, this is exactly what they're going to do. The boosters are being, you know, I've basically been told, you want to bitch about, you know, top recruits leaving the area to go to some other school? Now's your chance. Now's your chance to put your money up where, you know, like, and that is exactly what has happened. And coaches saw, at least some coaches saw it coming. And I think a lot of people, you know, I think we're so conditioned to think, all right, this is how it's supposed to be, as opposed to we're just going to muscle up through this and it's going to change. Now, I don't know if it was surprising that it took 7 months from that point for it to get that way. I don't even think it took that long, to be honest, because I've heard stories of, you know, from September of schools with money people basically buying recruits to commit to schools. And that was, you know, whatever it was, that was probably 3 months after it. But it is, you know, it's really interesting because it feels like a long time ago and it's really not even a year from that story. And it was just like, I remember having like kind of a little bit of an epiphany when I was on the phone with this person about what this was going to change. Because again, I think a lot of us were like, okay, this would be great for like the women's gymnast. And this would be great for the kid who goes back to their local community to run a football camp or, you know, does a deal with a local pizza company. And all those things can still be good. And all those things can still happen. But it's like the stuff that is going to be difference makers when it comes to competition and when it comes to recruiting and the enticement, that's the stuff that was only a matter of time before it just kind of, the floodgates were open.
And for me, I was focused on myself. I was focused on all the positive benefits, and those have happened, by the way, in terms of, you know, non-revenue athletes being able to make money. We've seen walk-ons, you know, being part of NIL deals. That's all great. I'm not naive. I knew boosters would try to use it, you know, as a loophole to buy recruits. I did not anticipate that it would be at this scale this quickly, where you've got these highly organized, you know, collectives. The dollar figures, certainly the $2 million a year for the five-star 2023 recruit. I mean, we went to that real fast. And so everybody's in a little bit of shock. But part of it is college sports is not big on a free market. You know, it has never been a free market. There's always been constraints that, you know, whether you're talking about transfers, not being able, you know, having to sit out a year, you know, even you could argue number of scholarship reductions in some way or a cap on the free market. But certainly what they're trying to do right now is control a free market. The last 10 months we've seen NIL as a free market with no regulations, no enforcement. And you're seeing what's happening. You're seeing the numbers. And now they want to step in 10 months later and suppress that, put a stop on that. And so I think it's going to be an interesting legal fight. I also don't know I don't know why the Gene Smiths of the world have such confidence that the NCAA Enforcement Department is going to, like, ride in like Superman to the rescue here. We're still talking about the same group of people, and it's a very small group of people. I think I saw that there's only 15 people in the NCAA Enforcement Department right now who can't figure out a way to sanction Kansas basketball for things that happened in 2017, who constantly, these are the same people that couldn't figure out a way to bust UNC for two decades of academic fraud. And now they're saying, we want you to go in. And by the way, these collectives, they have lawyers. They're not dumb. They've been preparing for this. We want you to go in and save us from this, this out of control market that we're seeing. And when I read some of the language in the guidelines, I was like, oh, you could already kind of see how they're going to get around it. Like, for example, in this list of guidance related to prospective student athletes, a booster NIL entity may not communicate with a PSA, that's a prospective student athlete, a PSA's family, or others affiliated with the PSA for a recruiting purpose or to encourage the PSA's enrollment at a particular institution. I can already see when they go to interview the guys at the collective, they're going to say, oh, it wasn't for a recruiting purpose. We were just talking to him about his marketing abilities and how much money he can expect to make as a college athlete because he's so marketable. NIL agreements must be based on an independent case-by-case analysis of the value that each athlete brings to an NIL agreement as opposed to providing compensation or incentives for enrollment decisions. I've seen some of these contracts. There is no mention of enrollment, of you have to enroll at X school. We know that that's what's really happening, but it's not in writing. So how do you prove that they didn't do this independent case by case, that they didn't look at five star X and say, based on his popularity and his what we think he's going to accomplish in college, we think he is worth X, as opposed to we're making this number based on what we think it would take to get him to come to our school. So it's going to be a lot of technicalities.
What is the price you put on art? I mean, it's hard to say it. It's like, look, there's car dealers who often are boosters of local programs. They may provide a car to a star player if they had a really good game. What is the fair compensation for that? Is it one tweet about the dealership? You know, it's just, I think it's a very, very vague thing that they're going to take a swing at. I think it would not be surprising if in fact the people inside the Pac-12 are right and they think the NCAA is going to try to make example of one school or somebody. But when they do that, you know, what happens then all of a sudden to, you have so many other examples of collectives and different things where they've been very aggressive. And it's like, okay, you're going to go after this school, but not that school, or this entity, but not that entity, especially when I think a lot of these places, from my understanding, have been running things by compliance offices. Now, that doesn't give you complete cover, but you would think they're not going into this completely blind. And so this to me, and I could be wrong, there may be examples of this that are counter to it, but of the booster, one individual rogue booster off, you know, kind of booster off the grid who paid somebody's relative in their town something, and it was kind of sloppily done, and maybe they can get caught for that. Like, a lot of this seems a little, as best I can tell, as best we can tell, more buttoned up. So, you know, who knows? But I do think there's going to be some areas where, you know, and I don't know how, because you said their enforcement staff isn't that big, but just like, I remember going back to this again, Arizona State is still in its own issues with its own scandal under Herm Edwards. And one of the things that I remember talking to a school that's not even in their conference about some of the ASU issues, and they pointed out, you know, when you start interviewing recruits, a lot of them don't know what the rules are. So they may speak freely about things that they just assumed are okay. And that's where things sometimes get tripped up. It's just, you know, like how is this going to work out? Like, how big of a net can the NCAA cast at this point from a manpower and resources aspect on this thing too?
Well, I got to figure that their first, one of, if not their first targets is going to be John Ruiz.
I would think it's going to be actually Tennessee.
I would say it's one of those two.
Because maybe Tennessee is already in their crosshairs from the Jeremy Pruitt stuff.
Yeah, Tennessee, and like I said, Spire has been as public and brazen about this. I mean, a lot of these collectives are trying to be pretty secretive. They're out there in the open. So I'd say it's either them or John Ruiz. John Ruiz has almost been tempting fate by tweeting out numbers, and he keeps going on these tweet rants about how he's doing it the right way. And he thinks that the collectives, or he's, you know, it's for his own agenda, but the collectives, the ones that are, especially the ones that are organized as nonprofits, are in trouble because they won't be able to.
Well, the nonprofit part does seem a little
dicey.
Yeah, I think that's different. By the way, John Ruiz is an attorney, so
right.
That doesn't mean he has all the answers, but I think he'd be likely to be more buttoned up on this front than some of the others who do not have that background.
Well, his thing is that he has a legitimate company. It wasn't a collective that was formed 3 months ago. It was an existing company. He's paying Miami athletes to endorse that company. There should be at least some sort of paper trail showing that they actually did work in exchange for their money. Now, he has definitely contacted recruits. He has said he you know, the Cavender twins from Fresno State who transferred to Miami, he definitely met with them before they signed with Miami. So, you know, according to these guidelines that were just handed out, he should be in trouble for that. That should be an open and shut thing. But I think he's going to come back and say, I wasn't meeting with them to recruit them to Miami. I was meeting with them to talk about their business opportunity. I'm a business and they're a client. It's going to take them years. You know, they will try to make an example of somebody. It will take years to play out. And in the meantime, like, if this is meant to be a deterrence, think about, we're only 10 months into this. Think about how much more this is going to progress over the next few years.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey, you want to talk about some football?
Yes, let's get into it. I think I know where this is headed. You want to talk about the Pac-12.
I want to talk some conference title odds.
Yeah. Are these legitimate? I will ask you that.
These are courtesy of BetOnline, betonline.ag.
All right. So we have, as we're looking at the email, you and I are both looking at the same email, the Power Five odds to win each conference in 22-23.
Let's go straight to the Pac-12 because that was the one that raised the most eyebrows. USC, 4-8 team last year. Yes, they have Caleb Williams. Yes, they have Travis Dye. Yes, they have Lincoln Riley. Are the favorites at 2-1, followed by It depends. I mean, as we know, these you know, Vegas odds makers are trying to determine. You know, it's less about actual.
So you're not surprised. Just say yes or no.
I'm surprised it's that low. I'm not surprised that they would give them really good odds because
put them at like 4-1.
Yeah, that they know the public. A lot of the public's going to bet on Lincoln Riley, but 2-1.
I will tell you the thing that jumped out at me. Arizona State, the fourth best price tag here, 17-2. Arizona State has like, you may be a scholarship receiver for them right now. They are so depleted because they've had so many players and key players jump in the portal to get away from that place. It has been in total disarray. The odds that only USC, Oregon, and Utah are considered, you know, better, you know, a stronger pick than them, like, I honestly would not be surprised if they were the worst team in the Pac-12.
I was just going to say, I was wondering if I could get 17-2 odds to pick them to finish dead last in the conference. Because think about this disparity here. They've got Arizona State at 17-2. So roughly, you know, I'm not a math genius, but roughly 9-1, right? Let's say 9-1. Stanford is 80-1. Colorado is 200-1. And Arizona is 500-1. Would it surprise you? On a scale of 10, how much would it surprise you if it come the end of the season, Arizona has a better record than Arizona State?
I don't know, 2?
Yeah. So this tells me this isn't based at all on returning, you know, guy. They haven't been looking at the portal necessarily. It's just last year's record.
This, the odds makers who did this basically are running on the same calendar as the old preseason guide edit calendar, which meant it would always go to print like before spring football. So you'd have a lot of stuff that was very felt stale and dated, and the portal changed things and everything else has changed things. And I feel like, quite honestly, that's how the ASU view on this is.
Okay. So who should be the betting favorite? I have my idea, and it's for some reason the team that won it last year that for some reason now has the third best odds, Utah at 5-1.
Yeah, I don't, and I, like right now I would have, that's probably around where I would have them. I mean,
I'm not saying they're invincible, but they're definitely, to me, the team to beat.
Yeah, they're the most stable team there. I mean, I'm, you know, I think this speaks to kind of the weakness of the Pac-12, right? USC has to do a lot of upgrading personnel-wise on their defense if they're going to be like a real 2-1. Oregon has recruited well, but it's a new staff. There's a lot of question marks there. I think that's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit inflated. ASU, I wouldn't have anywhere near there. UCLA, I think, is fine. To me, UCLA is very similar right now to Utah. They're a very physical team. They have the best, probably the best running back in the league. They have a really experienced quarterback. Defensively, they've been very average, though. And they got to get better on that.
Average is being kind.
Well, they were like 60th last year, Stu. I mean, that's average. But then you look at Washington, new staff. Washington State, new staff. Oregon State is 40-1. I think, you know, that's about right. Cal, 66-1. You know, that feels about right. You know, Stanford is the third, you know, lowest here. And that shows you kind of how far, you know, what people think of them at this point. So I don't think it's shocking. It's just, this is what you're picking out of the Pac-12.
Let's move to...
Can I tell you the price that jumped out at me as like maybe the best values to me on this?
Of any conference?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. I want to go to the ACC. So we have Clemson at 2-3, Miami at 5-1, Pitt at 9-1, and there it is. NC State, 10-1. I really like NC State at 10-1. They have what I arguably, outside of maybe Alabama, the best crew of linebackers in the country. Devin Leary has played a lot of football. He's good. They do lose Icky up front, but this is a pretty talented team. 10-1, I really like the pack out of the ACC.
You're absolutely right. Now, I think NC State on paper has the best team returning in the ACC, even better than Clemson. And yet, it's like, you know, people weren't going to believe that Georgia would actually win the national title until it happened. When's the last time NC State won the ACC? In the 70s?
And they didn't win it when Russell Wilson was there.
No. So. You know, they've always been this really, this program that just never quite seemed to climb the mountain. Something always goes wrong. And so, you know, I'm kind of hesitant to say they're going to win the ACC, but I would agree with you that those are interesting odds. By the way, what about your guys at Wake Forest who had a really good season last year, won 11 games, and yet they're 20-1 to win the ACC.
Yeah, sorry. As we're talking, I'm looking back to see when the last time NC State, you know, did that. I don't even know, because it's like they had 1973. They were undefeated in the ACC under Lou Holtz. I don't know if that was a team.
That doesn't surprise me. If you were to tell me he was the last coach there to win the ACC, I would believe you. By the way, Wake Forest, again, like I said, Wake Forest, there's just no respect for the little guys here. Wake Forest, 20-1 to win the ACC. Texas is 2-1 to win the Big 12.
Yeah. By the way, the one that I'm kind of, the other one I would be intrigued by is, because it's such a long odd, Louisville has a really good quarterback. I think they have a good coaching staff, and they are 66-1. 66-1 is a huge, huge underdog.
I get the feeling as soon as we log off today, you're going to be hopping on that site. NC State's last ACC championship was actually in 1979. I could give you 100 guesses. You would not guess who the coach was.
I'd be cheating. I know it's Bo Ryan.
You did know that? Oh, okay. They went 7-4.
I know he followed Holtz, and I know the guy before after him was Monty Kiffin. I don't know how long Monty was there, but I know Monty was the guy after him in the around 1980.
Bo Rain.
Ryan.
Is it okay? I'm gonna have to make a confession here. I didn't know who he was, as evidenced by the fact that I just mispronounced the last name. And I certainly didn't know this detail.
Did you know what happened to him?
No. The following the 1979 season, he had taken the job at LSU, but was killed in an aircraft accident in January 1980 before he coached a game for the Tigers. He passed away at the age of 34. No, I did not know any of that. I guess because you were already following you. You're since you're so much older than me. You were already.
First of all, I'm actually not that much older than you. And people think we're the same age, by the way. I had somebody tell me that at our offsite.
They think we're the same age?
Yes.
Somebody who's seen both our hair colors?
Yes. Somebody who's seen both of us in person, physically. Huh. Don't fool yourself. You do not look like you are. People remember. People think you're older than Teddy Greenstein in the Northwestern thing. So.
Well, I guess I better get to the gym. That doesn't speak well for me. Any other? The Big Ten, obviously you knew Ohio State was going to be the overwhelming favorite, and they are at 1-2. Little surprise who comes next, though. Not a team from the Big Ten East, but Wisconsin at 10-1.
I know the price you like here most. It is 28-1. It is the Minnesota Golden Gophers. Stu, tell the listeners why you are sweet on the Gophers at that price.
I do like the Gophers, but if I would not, you could not get me to bet on anybody at Ohio State. Just than C.J. Stroud and all those guys. By the way, there's a team that went 3-9 last year that has the fifth best odds to win the Big Ten. Do you know who that is?
I do. They're due for some good breaks. I don't know if I'm buying Nebraska. Only 14-1, though. That's better. You know. You know what's a little nuts to me on that? Wake Forest just had a great year. Wake Forest has a lot of really good players back. You know, not just the quarterback, not just A.T. Perry, even like a receiver who may be every bit as good who missed last year, and they're 20-1. And here is Nebraska having an abysmal year at 14-1.
The recurring theme, Bruce, is that they clearly think the public just wants to bet on big names, right? USC, Texas, Nebraska. I mean, think about that. Texas went 5-7 last year, hasn't been all that good in about 15 years, and they are 2-1 to win the Big 12. I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but how can it be 2-1?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, ESPN in their preseason rankings has Texas number 6 right now. Texas, yeah. Number 6.
I did notice that there's a pretty strong correlation between these odds and the FPI, because I know Wake Forest is low in those. Any of those kind of preseason
FPI or whatever it is, FPI is total crap.
I don't think it's total crap.
You don't. But they're number six.
No,
that is crazy. I don't think it's total crap.
They had somebody else like outrageously high last year. We're like, that has to be a misprint. I forgot who it was.
I think as the season goes on, any of those power ratings tend to normalize themselves. But right now, they're just a guess. And so I don't know their exact method. I know Bill Connolly's methodology better than I know FPI, and recruiting rankings are a high part of it, as you would expect, right? Like that's recruiting rankings are, you know, if you're trying to predict how somebody's going to do,
those are dated things. Like, I mean, I think people would be going to the mat on USC because they still had high recruiting ranked players who didn't live up to that.
Well, that's probably why USC has such great odds in this thing, right? Because their recruiting rankings are good for the most part. They did have that one really bad year. And then you add in Caleb Williams and Lincoln Riley, and that's how you end up where you are. But yeah, these power rankings are always going to, in the preseason at least, favor the big name teams that recruit, because Wake Forest doesn't do that. So if recruiting rankings are part of it, Wake Forest recruiting rankings are going to drag down their preseason ranking regardless of what they did last season.
I think some of this has to do with what you said. It's the name thing. Sometimes those rankings are tied into the name thing too. Whereas, you know, if it's a site or a place that gets kind of bloated fan base, sometimes their recruiting rankings get a little bit of a sweetener.
So in the preseason FPI, Texas is number six. Is that right? Yep. Auburn is 10. Utah is down at 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Baylor, who won the Big 12 last year, is 20. Your NC State Wolfpack are outside the top 25. So, yeah, it's, you know, Nebraska is not that high, but you say it. You jump all over
crap.
Our friends.
I think
at
it's
ESPN.
Absolute crap.
Okay. All right.
Odds for the Big 12, which one you like as a value?
Baylor. I know they lost a lot of their core players, but I still think that they're more proven. I think they're 15-2. Like I'm not sure who I'll pick to win the Big 12. I just know that Baylor being that much worse odds than Texas doesn't make any sense to me.
You feeling good about JT Daniels in Morgantown with his old coach?
Actually, I'll tell you who has great value is Kansas State. Kansas State is a team that when I last did my early top 25, I strongly considered including in the top 25. I mean, they've got Adrian Martinez now, so you probably have them like 3-1. We haven't touched the SEC. Alabama 1-1 odds to win the SEC, and I actually have trouble disagreeing with that. Followed by Georgia at 5-4, A&M at 11-1, and then a big drop off to Florida and Ole Miss at 33-1. Do you see anybody outside of Alabama, Georgia, or A&M winning the conference this year?
I don't see anybody outside of Alabama or Georgia. I wouldn't put A&M in that batch at this point. As I'm looking at this, like, what would I say is the long shot that I'm like beyond the top three that I'd be like, ooh, I kind of like that price. Hey, if you want to get in on Spencer Rattler, South Carolina, 100-1.
What if I want to get in on the Brian Kelly era at LSU? Because they're, and this is, you know, you talk about recruiting rankings and big name programs. I'm really actually surprised that LSU is 50-1. They're treating them like they're treating they have LSU with lower odds than Kentucky, and I don't necessarily blame them. I'm just surprised given the love for the big recruiting powers in the other conferences.
Yeah, I mean, look, LSU will have as talented a defensive line as there probably is. I don't know how strong I feel about their offensive line. That had been an issue. They're trying to rebuild it. You know, they have a bunch of different options at quarterback. I think the receivers will be good. I 50-1 doesn't surprise me. Look, Auburn 66-1, and that's a top 10 team according to ESPN's FPI, 66-1 for Auburn. Arkansas, who had,
you know,
I think,
what? I'm starting to realize something. Arkansas, I feel like
that the people at BetOnline kind of mailed it in on the other conferences, and then the SEC, they actually put some time and thought into it, because these actually do match up pretty closely with what I would think the expectations are. Arkansas is pretty low at 66-1.
That surprised me too. I liked what Arkansas did with offseason, the people they added transfer wise. I think they definitely brought in some really talented guys on defense. It's just, man, that division is so loaded.
I think they're having trouble giving. Yeah, I'm sure that's a big part. When you've got Alabama 1-1 to win the conference, that alone means that any other SEC West team, they don't think has much of a chance.
I mean, what's interesting to that is what you just said, but you have the Big Ten, Ohio State is even more of a favorite. They're 1-2. And in their same division, you have an 11-1 and a 12-1 in Michigan and Penn State. And then you have Michigan State at 25-1. So I'm sure the math works out, maybe. But it's interesting to me because, in that same division, where you have a 1-1 as opposed to a 1-2, you have 11-1, and then you have to drop all the way down to a 33-1, and then a 50-1 for the next best prices in the SEC West. See what I mean?
Might have to get somebody from BetOnline on the pod next week to explain themselves.
We've already given them plenty of publicity. It's fine.
What do you say we get to the mailbag?
As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com.
Yep, Bruce, this one's right up your alley from Max Cradleman. Hey, Bruce and Stu, it's about Matt Rhule. There's been some speculation that this will be his last season in Carolina before making the jump back to the college game. How will ADs evaluate his stint in the NFL? If he were to return, what interest would he garner? Would it be from programs considered a step back from Baylor? Or Saban and Pete Carroll landed some pretty sweet jobs at the NFL. After the NFL, do you see Rhule doing the same?
I do see Rhule doing the same. I mean, he did a really good job at Temple, and he did a great job at Baylor. He could have gone to being the head coach at Oregon. Instead, he chose Baylor, which was a big rebuild, as you know, not just from a branding-wise, but just to coming off the Briles, Ken Starr, Ian McCaw, you know, just it really needed the right guy to elevate and get people to hit the right tone. And he did all that. He evaluated extremely well, as evidenced by a lot of the players that were at this year's combine. I think his fingerprints were all over the team. Not to say Dave Aranda didn't deserve a ton of credit, but like those were mostly his guys on that Baylor Big 12 title team. So if Matt Rhule is out of the NFL, if it comes to that, I think he will be a huge free agent for. And the other thing with Matt Rhule is he's a guy who has spent time, obviously, in Texas. He is from the Northeast. I mean, there's not a place, because I think if you can do well at Baylor in Texas, I think you could handle the SEC. If you can be Texas, you can be the SEC. I think he is one of those guys who's not very regional. I think I could see Matt Rhule just about anywhere. So to me, he would be a huge commodity out there if there's a big job open.
I feel like colleges pretty much ignore. If you don't work out in the NFL, that doesn't like invalidate what you did as a college coach. Think back to...
You 100% on that?
Think back to Arkansas hiring Bobby Petrino amidst a disastrous first season at with the Atlanta Falcons. Think about Chip Kelly. Didn't his last 49ers team go like 1-15, 2-14, something like that? And people were, you know, schools were bidding against each other to get him.
Let me ask you this. If Urban wanted to come back and coach.
That's different. That's
why is that different?
Because the other ones were like Matt Rhule's not having, he hasn't been part of some scandal. He just hasn't had winning teams. The Urban's, and also let's not forget Urban's college tenure ended in scandal. So It's an accumulation of baggage there. No, I don't think, or we've talked about that. We don't need to keep going back. We already know what his job's going to be this fall. It's not going to be on a college sideline.
All right. Next question, Stu.
Next question is from Evan in Charlotte. Oh, good. A realignment question. Longtime fan of the pod. Which of these two scenarios do you see is more likely to occur before the end of the ACC's infamous TV deal that runs through 2036? One, the ACC adds Notre Dame, signaling a continuation of the current conference landscape, and the ACC becomes revitalized as a financially competitive power conference. Or two, the SEC adds Clemson and Miami, indicating a collapse of the ACC and a consolidation of the major brands into super conferences led by the SEC and the Big Ten. Is there an option three?
My instinct was going to say one, just because when I heard the Clemson and Miami thing, I was like, yeah, they like the part that doesn't, I don't think, and I could be wrong now because I feel like some of this stuff can is more fluid than it used to be. But like, would Florida want Miami and the SEC? Would they do everything they could to block it? The thing is, I don't know how well some of those things hold up when, you know, Texas A&M, Texas stuff happens.
Are we sure that Clemson and Miami would be the two? I think Clemson would definitely be one of them.
I mean, if Miami gets, if Mario Cristobal gets Miami back to where it is, it's a huge TV market. They rate really well on TV. You look at their history, they rate, you know, they are a national brand.
I agree. You know, the issue with all these things is there is a grant of rights that the ACC schools have handed over their rights through 2036 and a long time. And maybe you can break them. Nobody has ever tried to break a grant of rights. There has always been speculation that if you actually did take it to court, you might be able to get out of it. But if you couldn't, whew, that's a lot of lost money. So I think the only way scenario two happens is if the entire, is if the ACC as a whole collapses and they're just kind of able to get out of it.
I don't think that's going to happen. And, you know, like, I just think that ESPN is too invested in the ACC for it to collapse. I think Jim Phillips, you and I both, I think, respect him a lot, especially as it relates to other leaders around college sports. I just think that they have, and again, I could be proven wrong, but I just think ESPN's too invested in the ACC for it to just collapse.
And when you say too invested, you mean because they have the ACC network?
Yeah.
But they also have the SEC network.
They do, but I just don't think, you know, there's a big element of basketball, which is a lot of programming that they have. Mm-hmm. I mean, it basically carries their network from I don't know, from basically January to April.
January to through the conference tournaments.
Through March, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I mean, programming, like, never underestimate the value of programming to TV networks. You know, it just, it's something. I mean, you see it, like, I can see it now with Fox as it relates to the USFL, right? It's like, I think, you know, not to speak too far out of school, but I just feel like people would do anything to avoid having two guys just talk constantly. The irony of this on our podcast to say this.
The only way Notre Dame is going to join the ACC, what's the incentive of Notre Dame to join the ACC at this point, assuming we get an expanded playoff? If it's going to be four for the rest of time, then maybe Notre Dame starts to second guess. Maybe,
unless you can tell Notre Dame people, hey, we will prevent your lacrosse program from getting screwed.
I gotta pay more attention to that controversy. It kind of snuck up on me.
It is actually, there's a couple of college sports that I feel like are vastly underappreciated. Lacrosse is getting there. I feel like both, you know, women's basketball has gotten there, but I feel like softball and baseball are really entertaining sports with colleges, and I just feel like the more people see of them, they'll appreciate it. And I definitely feel like lacrosse is in there.
Funny you mentioned that, Bruce. I went to my first college softball game this past weekend. I took my daughter to the Stanford-Oregon softball game, and you're right. And I often end up watching the Women's College World Series. That's an exciting sport.
All right. So I don't know if I got an answer.
So we didn't really give a conclusive answer to him. What I would just say is, and I've said this for years, is that, and it's especially, you know, the NIL situation, I think, is only going to increase the likelihood of this, is that you're going to see a collapse of the conference models entirely. You're going to see the top 25 or 30 college football programs form their own super league, as he refers to here. And Clemson and Miami would be in that. But I don't know that the... I don't know that it would mean, yes, the SEC and Big Ten are pulling away from everybody else. I don't, that crazy idea I just said seems more likely to me than the SEC and Big Ten joining forces. I think, and I'm not sure the SEC and Big Ten have ever been more philosophical opposites than they are right now.
I would agree with that. I just think the leadership just doesn't seem to be on the same page. I just feel like the fan bases are kind of unique to themselves, and that's okay.
Now, I would say Ohio State has more in common with a lot of the SEC than they do with a lot of the Big Ten. And that's why I think you'll see big-time college football programs like that, Texas, USC, you know, the Blue Bloods, team up at some point, because they're going to be playing in a different sport where the money is just so stratospherically higher than what Wake Forest is playing with or Purdue's playing with. And it's just not going to, that model's not going to continue to hold up. That's more likely to me than the two exact scenarios that Evan gave us. Okay, he addressed this to me, but I'm going to address it to you because you know a lot more about the NFL draft. Blaine from Virginia says, "Dear Stu, you are a big time supporter of watching college film over combine measurables for NFL draft scouting. But aren't there limits to this when the team is too good? How can you know that the fifth best player on the Georgia defense is a first-round draft pick when guys ahead of him make him look so good on film?"
It's a good question. I mean, look, one of the things that I really try to do with the way I do my mock draft was talk to coaches who faced these players, because they're the ones who are, as opposed to just watching the film, they know what they're trying to do to them. So they know how the player is used. They know how they're trying to exploit him or work around him. And I think that's the part, but it's also a big projection, you know, in terms of what is somebody going to become. I go back to like Ziggy Ansah, who, you know, flashed a little bit, but was really more of a what can he become as opposed to what do we think he is right now. I think you also have to factor in, you know, the NFL is a much more physical game. And so how well will somebody hold up? We've seen plenty of guys who, you know, they look great in college, and then all of a sudden when it's in that level, like, look, you know, our guy Scooby Wright was just racked up stats and was everywhere for Arizona. And he didn't last very long in the NFL. Now, maybe he's getting a second win in the USFL. But I just think in terms of length and some of the things that really maybe you can work around in college, those things, you know, I go back to some of the position coaches I know in the NFL who are really in the details, and they'll kind of explain. And this is a good example, like David Bell, Purdue receiver, right? You remember him?
Was all I remember American him? Caliber. I loved him.
Yeah, all American caliber. And so when I talked to a couple of NFL position coaches, because I think one of our colleagues at The Athletic, I think it was Scott Docterman, did an interesting story about David Bell maybe a month ago. And the comparison was maybe he can have a career like Jarvis Landry or Anquan Boldin, both physical receivers who were not, you know, they were 4'6 and change, maybe 4'7 guys. And when I brought that up to some position coaches, they're like, yeah, but Anquan Boldin had a suddenness. The challenge is if you're a guy who just does not have that ability to change gears and kind of have that burst, you're going to have a hard time in the NFL. And I think those are the things where it's like, I think that's the stuff that the NFL, you know, the experts probably have a better feel for than we do. Or it's like, oh, this guy was just really, really good in college, but you forget who he's going up against as opposed to who will be going up against in the NFL, where it's just so much different. And I think that's the part where it's also a projection. You know, like I had a scout I talked to for one of my stories to talk about Dakobe Durant, who is one of the best HBCU players. And, you know, Clemson fans might remember me had two picks against them. But like what was interesting was he came to college. He was like 150 some pounds. He was in a program that did not have the same resources if he was like an SEC program. And so he never got really, you know, above like, he probably put on like 15 pounds in college. Whereas in this process, you know, now they think he's going to be like 195 pounds. So I think you're projecting a guy as to what he's going to be, as opposed to maybe what they see right now.
I thought he was going to say, well, I don't know what I thought he was going to say, but wouldn't I, Mike, if I were asking that question or question like that, my bigger question would be not so much, how do you evaluate the fifth best player on the Georgia defense? It would be more like, how do they evaluate these FCS players who aren't playing against NFL, you know, for the most part, other future NFL players? How do you project, how a guy who's playing against...
Is it that much different than a MAC player, though? I mean, the Missouri Valley, to me, you know, is very close to right now what the MAC is.
I think you're right about that. I'm guessing, you know, there's a range, right, across FCS. The North Dakota States, I mean, clearly they've figured that they made an evaluation on Trey Lance. If it's a lower rung FCS league and you're projecting how that guy's going to go from playing against Furman to how he's going to do playing against the Green Bay Packers, seems very challenging to me, but that's why I don't do that for a living.
And that's why they want to get him in the Senior Bowl, where they can watch them practice, you know, have rep after rep against other top level players. You know, I just remember, you know, it was invaluable for me to do the Senior Bowl story I did at midseason. They talked a lot about Cole Strange. I think Cole Strange did play Kentucky, so there's a little bit of sample size. You do have guys, you know, Bernhard Reimann, who was the Austrian exchange student offensive tackle for Central Michigan. He did play against LSU, and obviously LSU has a lot of talented defensive linemen, so you can get more than a snapshot of what they, you know, like in that window. I think the harder thing is when, you know, it's a Division II guy, and there's, you know, like there's very few, like Kyle Duggar was one and the Patriots took him, and he was definitely a measurables guy. You know, my guy Derek Young, like I've had a bunch of guys on the freaks list who were, you know, like athletes that really kind of wow people. I'm like, okay, what is he going to develop into? You know, I had one who was a Division II All-American, Jason Poe, who numbers-wise is 6'1", 300 pounds, and runs as well as a lot of fullbacks. And that's what some teams are looked at him as. So I think, you know, once they see the numbers and the scouts are really good at that, then all of a sudden they start watching the film and they're like, okay, is there something we can work with here? You know, and it's not like, I think they're looking for traits, and I think they're looking for things that, like, can they develop into something, as opposed to, is this guy a finished product, and are we counting on him right now, as opposed to, can he develop into something?
All right. I think that puts a wrap on our episode. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. I swear one of these episodes we'll get to a point where we're not talking about NIL and collectives, but this, we're clearly not there yet. We'll see you next time.